Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network, a station dedicated to the concept that all manifestations of the divine are equally valid. Join Reverend Terry Power HP, Robin McKean, and all the hosts for programming covering a wide range of spiritual topics, right here on Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Economics and the Spiritual Path, hosted by David Axelrod with guidance from Dax. Each show expands on the language, ideas, and insights from economic thought that can empower and enlighten the journey through your inner environment toward healing, creativity, and spiritual expression.
Well, hello, and welcome to Economics and the Spiritual Path again. I'm David Axelrod. If you would like to call in and be part of the conversation, the phone number is 646-564-9714. That is 646-564-9714. So tonight, we're going to run this show slightly differently than we have. We will have Scott Axelrod on as a co-host for tonight. Scott is his background in mathematical physics and has been a longtime thinker about religious and spiritual and social issues, and I believe you will find his insights and perspectives very interesting. So as a quick synopsis before we get into conversation with Scott, we've been going over some basic ideas about decision making and how economists would look at decision making. How an expanded view allows us to understand economics as the nexus of science and religion and art and spirit, that we can look at the nature of reality as sort of the intersection of memory and imagination, which can also be understood as the material and the spiritual, or in terms of constraints, opportunities, limitations, and preferences. We've also talked a little bit about growing, healing, and transformation, and the healing-growing cycle. And we've talked a little bit about the five relationship modes, that being combat, conflict, competition, cooperation, and community, and how that can also be seen as on a continuum and to another extent, even on a cycle or phases. And last week we started talking about social choice with the insight that there are many persona we experience through, the idea being that in the same way that when we act in the world, you know, sometimes they're slightly different people depending on what we're doing, right? So we're a little bit different when we're hanging out with our friends and we're doing something fun as compared to who we are if we're being more professional at work. Or, you know, if you go to the gym, maybe you're sort of like, you know, like a focused athlete. And so we're familiar with that, but at the same time, in terms of how we take information in, how we take in how other people are acting, we also have different modes and different persona by which we listen to people. And so depending on who we are at that time, we would hear people very differently and might have very different reactions and responses. So let me bring Scott Axrod in on the conversation. Scott, you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Doc. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you, Scott. I greatly appreciate you being here for the show. And,
well, thanks for having me.
And I am quite confident that our listeners will greatly enjoy what you have to say as well.
Well, thanks for having me on, Doc.
So I presume you were able to hear the quick little synopsis of what we've done so far in the first 7 weeks of the show.
Yes, I did. Can you hear me now? I just want to make sure again.
Yeah. Yep, I can hear you.
So I wanted to say first of all,
go ahead.
Joe, just wanted to thank you for having me on and for your kind introduction, and I hope you haven't raised expectations too high, but let's have some fun.
Yep. So why don't we open up with, you know, either any particular experiences, like how spiritual, intellectual experiences or insights that you've had that you feel have, you know, either formed or transformed or enlightened how you view the world.
Okay, well, I'm going to throw out one that at a peak spiritual moment for me was very profound. And, you know, you go up and down to how you view those things in afterwards. But it was at a very peak spiritual moment. I just had the sense that God was raising mankind to be almost like a child, for someone for him to him or her to talk to. So that, you know, for example, the problem of bad things happening to good people is resolved because, again, along this long historical tradition of new information dethroning mankind from a central role, like the sun not being, the earth not being the center. We rotate about the sun the same way. Well, if we're being raised as one collective organism, then each of us is like a cell, and God may care about every single cell, but if you have a child, the child will have scrapes and bruises, and you don't think of those as evil, but just as growing pains. So there's lots you can do with this, but as you were giving your introduction, I was interpreting your words in two ways, because there was how, you know, you could be talking about the individual level, like you said, these five different modes, cooperation, competition, etc., or the different personalities you can have depending on context. So that's for an individual human being, but you could think of, I don't know, I don't even have standardized terminology, but let's say macro intelligences. It could be the intelligence of the whole human race, or maybe each nation. Let's think of each nation or each state having its own kind of collective consciousness. And so everything that you just said in your introduction seems to me applies to larger consciousnesses than just an individual human. I mean, countries have different personalities. They have those all those modes that you talked about. Anyway, so that's one thing I'm putting out there. So I'll stop right now and let you go.
Yeah, I am very sympathetic to that viewpoint. I think it's fairly natural to be able to imagine, you know, you have an individual cell in the body and it has its own particular awareness and, you know, possibly consciousness of the world. And there's trillions of cells in the body and actually, you know, the latest biological estimates would have that there's probably at least as many non-human cells within our body than human cells, which is kind of a fascinating thing. You know, one, just because it kind of makes you think about it, what is going on under my skin, for one thing. And the other, how similar that is to, you know, issues in politics and national identity. You know, how many countries are actually very dependent on, you know, foreign or alien, you know, bodies in the way of immigrants and such to survive. I mean, just thinking in terms of inside of our gut, all the all the flora, that it's those are non-human cells, but we are completely dependent on them to literally break down our food and help deliver it from the fields of our gut. So, you know, in the small, you know, in the micro or in the macro, it's a lot of the same issues. Sympathetic. Yeah, go ahead.
So, you know, what you just said is a good example of it's a good setup for talking about a parallel I see. If I think about the evolution of consciousness, or if you may prefer other words, or the evolution of self-awareness, the evolution of thought is the terminology I've been using. We can think about how single-celled organisms kind of evolve. Until at what point do you have something that you might call intelligence? I mean, before just simple, you know, action, reaction of chemicals, but when does it achieve? The parallel that I see is you just talked about the flora and the fauna, or the fauna in like the gut biome. I mean, there's this teeming mess of other kinds of cells that are not human tissue in our bodies, and it has to work together collectively. And so maybe even in our brains, I mean, how did these cells come together? And so I think of the evolution of up until we got human intelligence. Well, in modern times, there's a new kind of intelligence arising. And just like you might have these foreign cells, well, we have all these computer intelligences. Some might say, well, computers aren't intelligent yet, but there's certainly a sort of symbiosis going on between humans and computers now. We're all attached to our screens, and our screens, if not, you might not want to say help us think, but they certainly affect how we're thinking, how we're processing information. So I think of that, there's a historical parallel between evolution that happened in the past up until we arrived at human intelligence from single-celled organisms to evolution in the present, where we start with sort of the single cells or individual humans and other kinds of things like computer intelligence coming together. So we're sort of now inside of, we're like the cells sitting in an evolutionary soup that we think of ourselves as the important and ultimate thing, but we have a challenge to see the bigger picture of where things are going to.
Yeah, I think that's a very useful description of trying to figure out our place in the universe. You know, the challenge of you know, if you talk about spiritual development, you know, the challenge of going from you know, kind of early childhood where You know, it's all about trying to get attention so that you can get, you know, your basic needs met. You know, when it's difficult to do anything for yourself and it's difficult to communicate your needs and you really need someone, you know, either, you know, a parent or a guardian who's able to pick up on your cues about, you know, what do you need? You know, do you need, you know, do you need to eat? Do you need water? Do you need your, you know, diaper changed? You know, do you have something else going on? And, you know, evolving to the point where, you know, you can communicate yourself, to the point where you can take care of yourself, and eventually to the point where, you know, you can take care of others and, you know, hopefully at some point, you know, be able to pick up on the cues of other people, you know, in terms of what their needs are. And, that is one of the forms that spiritual path takes on. I mean, there's certainly others, but that's one. And then, of course, you know, the process of going toward the other end of life, where instead of being in the ascendancy, one is starting to maybe start losing some abilities or losing some facility with the world, and you know, eventually getting to the point where, you know, kind of letting go of being a primal force in the world. So, lots of changes in life.
So I guess you're kind of pointing out that essential aspect of spirituality is that it has to gird us to deal with the phases that we go through in life and the different kinds of relationships we have, that we're start as the child and we become the parent. And I also think, well, theistic religion, I mean, God is kind of, you know, the uber parent. I suppose many spiritualities, even if they're not theistic, have a notion of we have to have some sort of sense of there's something beyond us. And I think that when I talk about this evolution of new intelligence, consciousness, whatever you want to call it, in fact, once you recommended a book to me called Cosmic Consciousness, I mean, it's an old idea. It goes back. But in any case, I think if let's look to the past, what might we think of as how did human consciousness form and evolve over time as a guide to what might happen in the future? And you kind of think at some point when did we develop the ability that we have that internal monologue? There's a teeming plethora of all sorts of stuff going on subconsciously in our mind. Just think of the billions of neurons competing to sending signals back and forth to each other. And how did we, out of that, arise to have a single, probably at least for most people, maybe some people have more than one, but usually I think there's a single conscious voice, like our inner dialogue, which we think of as that is our consciousness stream, even though there's so much underneath the hood. So in the same case, I mean, Was that consciousness stream, that dialogue, the God of the individual neurons? I mean, did at some point the individual neurons cohere to work together to produce that individual voice? In the same way, are we working together to produce some sort of higher consciousness? And maybe that notion of God, maybe we could change it from some abstract incarnate being to more of a scientific notion. We're in the midst of this, and we're developing something that's maybe going to be beyond all of us, but it could be, I'm going to throw out one of your terms just for fun from one of your early albums, and you use the acronym for God, Generalized Objective Decision Maker.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so,
some of the points you're making reminds me of the work of Julian James. I think this is a book that came out in the 70s. It's called The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. And he presented a very interesting argument. He looked at the development of literature over time, going back to the Greeks. I think he actually went back a little bit further, but a lot of it started with, oh, yeah, not just the Greeks, but also looking at the some of the early stories in the Bible. He talked about how back then they kind of referred to almost like the different organs of your body as talking. So, you know, it would be your heart was talking, or your liver was talking, and that what he conjectured is that, well, kind of what was going on is that, you know, the different organs in the body was sending information to the brain, and, you know, most of the time the brain would just, you know, react and or respond pretty directly to whatever signal was coming from the organ. Either the organ was, you know, kind of communicating either an action, or if it needed resources, or, you know, to be tended to. And what he conjectured was that what happened is that eventually in you know, complex enough situations, you would have, you know, these multiple voices from the different organs all making requests simultaneously and running into sort of like an economic limitation, like not being able to fulfill all the requests from all the organs, and that the individual consciousness that we developed was an outgrowth of having to decide who to listen to, that in some way our most profound self is the one that decides, you know, who am I listening to? You know, like, who am I? And I thought that was interesting when I read it, and what you were just saying now kind of, you know, reminds me of that as well. And, you know, it relates to what you were saying before in terms of in the realm of the political. You know, maybe the United States, you know, has, a leader, you know, is president, and yet the president is still, you know, listening to a lot of different voices and ultimately, you know, makes decisions about who to listen to, who not to listen to.
Well, it's interesting the way you just phrased the breakdown of the bicameral mind book, that in a way sort of the result of an economic constraint process. You used that word I picked up, that somehow, yeah, we have, I'm just repeating, I think, to see if I understand how you put it, we have all these competing voices, and it's just too complex a system, basically as a constraint. We need to simplify it down, and we choose to decide what's the main voice that we listen to. And I wonder if in the past times before we had kind of our modern scientific view, if, you know, people did talk about, you know, what's in your heart. And I wonder if, you know, I have my internal voice. It seems like it's coming from inside my skull. But I wonder if people felt their consciousness distributed throughout their body, like just in a different way. In the past, or I wonder if people in the present do. I mean, do you ever feel? I mean, I have to admit, maybe that's a spiritual limitation. I don't know. I'm always in my head. You know, I'm aware of other organs, but it's being the head is the central processing unit, and everything else sends information. But that's where the final tally is. I don't know if you or people you know or people in the past had the central place they felt, not just because when they're in pain and their whole focus is there, but their being somehow is centered elsewhere.
Well, first of all, I think that's an interesting insight and question. You know, certainly, if you talk about the chakra system, yeah, those are energy centers, but they're also awareness centers. So in certain healing energy modalities, like Reiki, for example, that are built around working with chakra systems, it is the case that you will ask the person that's seeking healing, where are they being aware of, either the pain or, energy in the body. One of the responsibilities of a Reiki practitioner would be to be able to, essentially kind of feel where the energy distribution is in the body of the person that they're working with. But from an external, externally. But to answer your question, in terms of chakra systems, that's certainly one approach to understanding a distribution of awareness and consciousness in the body. And I'm very sympathetic to what you're saying about, being in the head a lot. as an economist, certainly I do a lot of thinking, do a lot of reasoning, and so there's a lot of stuff going on in the brain, and I kind of want to catch those thoughts while they're there. But that's not to say that you can't get other insights by being aware of other things going on inside your body. And that also, tying in what we were talking about before with, where we are in society or as part of society is, being aware of, higher consciousness or a higher entity. When you talk about a politician knowing the mood of a country, that's another form of energy awareness.
So that last comment would be the direction I would be interested in pursuing, but I'm going to back up and say a couple of things that crossed my mind when you were just talking and then get back to the last part. So first thing that popped into my mind when you were bringing up the chakras is, I guess, the parallel to Freud, the founder of modern psychiatry, that I think, he was more trained as a neurologist. And he was looking at physical explanations. I mean, I don't know if they use the terminology neurologist then, but in any case, how did the energy flow? And, he had an early theory of things were centered in the nose and your sense of smell. And so I guess even in the early on foundations, before people, settled on this is the one way we look at things in modern science, I guess it was more open to, we don't know where things are centered. Then a second point I was going to bring up when you talked about sort of distributed intelligence within, this was not your terminology, but I'm morphing it to distributed intelligence within, within your body or within other, other things. I hadn't experienced this, last February or so. I had to write a talk, but I was having this tremendous dizziness. So I couldn't do my normal system where when I write or I think about something, I pace a lot. And, so I think things through. And then I might sit down on the computer and do something. But I couldn't do my normal system because I got so dizzy. And, I just had to try something new. And it was the first time I really had a sense of I was collaborating with my computer, because I would type in some stuff. I'd be dizzy, whatever. I had to take a break. And then I'd come back, and it was like, well, the words were there, and it was almost like an external entity that this screen that I was – kind of in collaboration with what I was typing, and it was evolving, and I wasn't in control of it the same way. So, well, then I guess I'm just kind of scattering things about, but so I'll go on to the final point you were making about, well, a politician somehow senses the mood of the country. I mean, there is a collaboration between a leader and his, I don't want to say followers, because in the U.S. we would not want to say followers, but constituents, I'll say. Like somebody who is a representative and constituents, maybe that's a more democratic way of putting it, that there's a collaboration there just like between me and my computer screen to get something out, and I wasn't in total control. It went back and forth. Maybe these are little proto-examples of how a symbiosis leading to a more complex reasoning ability or consciousness or even emotion
mm-hmm.
can come about.
Yeah, I think those are important points you're making. It also, you know, raises an interesting question, which is, for those who are not familiar, there is something called the Turing test. And to those who may be listening. So the Turing test, essentially being that, if you can interact with the computer in such a way that, you know, they seem to be responding just like any human would, then, you know, maybe they are, you know, an intelligence at that point. Loosely saying what the Turing test is. In an environment where you have natural persons, from a legal sense, there are natural persons, those would be humans, and then you have artificial persons, which would be corporations. And now, you know, we've gotten to the point of saying that corporations have, you know, pretty much the same right as humans, and that for some corporations, you know, the way that they interact with the world is more and more either in terms of robots or through software, and it's not that far away from imagining a corporation that really doesn't have any human employees at all. It's all robots and software. And I just wanted to say that, and so at that point, when you're talking about society, at that point, you literally are talking about society, being composed both of humans and of, cyborg equivalents.
Well, interesting. You could even further the corporation question. What if a corporation has no human employees and actually buys back all its own stock? So there's no human owners at some point. No human employees, no human owners. It could be, say, Uber. And Uber, creates computerized drivers. You could have this, our entire transportation system could be run all automated and be owned by itself. And then you just have a, completely autonomous entity, which legally is as you just said, is the corporations have some form of legal personhood. And up until now, maybe we can deal with it because clearly we know they're different than ordinary humans. But as it becomes more complex and they take on, like you said, the Turing test, more and more features, even if it's a partial passing of the Turing test, you become less and less able to say clearly, what's so special about we humans compared to artificial humans? Or artificial persons, I think that was your term.
Yeah. I think if there's any lawyers out there that want to Correct me if I'm not quite right. Please, please feel free to call. No, although you probably already called in. But if you're listening and you'd like to make a comment, it's 646-564-9714. What I was going to say is that, at least my understanding, with corporations, they still need a board of directors. And I guess to the extent that the board of directors has to all be human, then at least there's that backstop. What happens when a corporation buys back all its stock? What if it turns, all its employees into robots and all of management are just apps? At what point do the board of directors not have to be a natural person? I think that will be the final changeover. You've got movies that play around with that. You've got a cartoon show called Futurama, placed in 1,000 years, where it's a world where, robots are just as much citizens as humans are, in some ways, maybe even more so. but it does raise a lot of interesting questions. So what I'm going to do right now is take a little music break so we can rest our voices. And,
okay.
Because we've been going at it pretty well, so let's take a short little break, and then we'll talk a whole lot more on the flip side. So we'll be back in about 6-7 minutes.
International Pagan Radio, a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week streaming radio station. We have informative Facebook page, interactive Facebook group, absorbing interviews with musicians, engaging shows with excellent hosts, and dynamic interviews with spiritual leaders. Come join us. We have the very best pagan music from around the world. we feature artists such as Dave the Bard, S.J. Tucker, Murphy's Midnight Rounders, Elaine Silver, Izon, Brian Hinkey, Robin Renee, Fawn, and so many more, all available for your listening pleasure 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We are also available on TuneIn Radio, so go to www.internationalpaganradio.com. It's all pagan, all the time.
Now we return to Economics and the Spiritual Path, hosted by David Axelrod.
Well, welcome back, everybody. That composition that you just heard was from the duo Mishabra, something called Sunday Morning at Our Lady of the Martian Protozoan. So a little nod to the off-planet spiritual endeavors of even single cells. So if you would like to call in, the number is 646-564-9714. And I'm going to reconnect with our guest today, Scott Axelrod. So, Scott, are you still there?
Yeah, can you hear me back?
Yep, very good. Okay, so we've been fairly wide-ranging and talking about sort of the nature of spirituality and decision-making, both in terms of the individual and in society, a little bit about sort of like, you know, consciousness of either different parts of our bodies, you know, with respect to chakra, or with respect to different parts of you know, of our community, sort of the kind of requirements of you know, politicians to be able to, you know, be aware, to be conscious of the mood of a country. You know, how that can change things pretty quickly, depending on whether you're attuned or not to the body politic, so to speak.
Well, since you just mentioned about politics and changing things quickly, that was a direction I was thinking about discussing. I have this term that I've come up with lately, which I call the political singularity. So let me give you a little background. There's this notion of the technological singularity, which has been around since 20, 30 years, but it's become very popular. And there's the notion that, well, once computers are as smart as people, once they can pass the Turing test, then almost immediately computers will be smarter than people because they're so much faster, et cetera, et cetera. And there will be a singularity, they say, that it's almost like a black hole singularity hidden behind a black hole event horizon. You can't picture what happens then. Actually, the term singularity in the context of this intelligence change was coined by Johnny von Neumann, the great mathematician, back in, I don't know if he did it in the 50s or the 40s, and it was just the mathematical notion of a singularity is a case where the mathematical rules kind of break down. So the notion that I have of the political singularity is that, well, all things evolve in time. So I talked before about how does thought evolve. So we could also, well, politics evolves along with things. And if we're going to take a little seriously the concept of there's a singularity happening because of the nature of intelligence changing, because of all these digital influences, that maybe there's also a political singularity happening, that our rules are just drastically changing at some point. If we Well, let me give some concrete pseudo example, if you like. At some point, cells had to organize themselves into neurons in the brain, and they needed a signaling process. Like, you know, at some point, these cells must have figured out how to send electrical impulses, which are the basis of neural signaling in the brain. So in the same way, it seems like Twitter has been a kind of a shift, or it is an ongoing shift that I think the notion that the President of the United States will be communicating in single tweets as like the stream of whatever you think of it is good or bad, but it's a stream of thought that's in this discrete thing. It's like neurons, probably pretty not that complex an entity, and the signaling between them just boils down to some simple pulses of information. So it's what's important isn't the superintelligence of the individual neuron, but the connectivity of the neurons and the fact that they can signal each other quickly. And so is this political singularity changing when the nature of communications, the magnificence of individual human thoughts and complex achievements are being downgraded, in that if what really matters is the complex entity, the importance of the individual humans is that they should be able to signal each other quickly. Everybody just, you know, wants to send out their signals. Anyway, so just kind of a risk there on some idea.
Yeah, I'm very sympathetic to that. You know, certainly in some of the things we've talked about, written about, you know, the notion of understanding, you know, the physical, emotional, rational, and spiritual in terms of how much time you have to make a decision, or the time frame of decision making. The idea being that if you think about the body, if you were to look at the behavior of the body as being the outgrowth of some decision that was made, you can, for example, understand a decision being at the physical level if it's immediate. In other words, you know how if you tap your knee, you know, typically you have a reflex response, you know, where you kind of kick your leg. And it has nothing to do with whether you want it to or not, or whether you think about it. It's just your body is wired. If you hit a nerve at a certain point, it will have a reflex response. And in many ways, the idea here is that if you want to respond to some stimulus in like less than a second, you already have to be hardwired to do it, right? You don't have enough time to take in the stimulus, think about it, and then send a signal out to the body to do something. If you're going to react, you have to do it without thinking, without even feeling about it. You just have to do it, you know, sort of like pulling your hand out off of a hot stove, or pulling your hand out of the fire. You know, if you want to avoid getting, you know, seriously injured, it has to be a physical decision. Your body just does it. And then at the next level, where you have a little bit of time, but you don't have enough time to really, you know, reflect on the decision you're making, that's sort of at the emotional level. And if you have enough time, then you can actually think about something. And this is also associated with the wiring of the body, because, you know, those signals that are coming in from the nerve cells and, you know, pain cells and the parts of your body that sends information to the brain, once it gets past the lower functioning of the brain, which is, you know, essentially the part that has the immediate reflexes, then it would have to go through the amygdala, which is going to be associated with emotion. And if you want to go even further than that into higher rational, you need even more time for the information to get up further into the brain. So certainly in terms of society, in terms of, a political singularity, in some sense, that's the same kind of deal. In this case, it's not a, within a particular body, but if you want to have an immediate response to something, so for example, if something's going on in a war zone and you need to have an immediate response, you may not have time to get the information up to the president. You know, if it's about a soldier defending themselves, they're not going to have enough time to get information up the chain of command. They either are going to react and defend themselves, or they're not. The fact that the president-elect is makes very deep use of Twitter is very interesting, because certainly, as you've pointed out, that's almost a reflexive or at best an emotional response, because it's so few characters, it's so quick to get out there, but there's that asymmetry, right? He'll be in a position to, send something off to millions, tens of millions of people, possibly without even, reflection, and yet at the same time, almost nobody is going to be able to communicate that quickly and directly to him. I guess part of the singularity is a rejiggering, so to speak, of what would be the physical and the emotional and the rational for society as a whole, and sort of power and authority really being determined by the asymmetry of the flow of information.
Yeah, I like the way you laid it out, kind of a broader perspective. I talked about individual neuron signaling, and that's at the lowest level, but you actually had a fourth component. You said there's the physical, the emotional, and the intellectual, and I believe then the spiritual. So
correct.
We're maybe in our collective consciousness that we often, or I as a self-admittedly in the head thinker, usually think of the intellectual stream, but the physical or material or economic stream is kind of the first level that you have to deal with. And as you said, you have all these reflex actions that are just kind of built in. But the insertion of the emotional in there is interesting. Like you point out how, well, basically the tweets in the political stream, especially in the president-elect, have this emotional content, it's interesting. I mean, because I guess maybe I was very simplified when I talked about the signaling and neurons, just, signaling with these electrical pulses, but there are also chemicals that relate to mood. We have all these antidepressant drugs, et cetera, that kind of bathe the whole brain almost in a mood, or changing our affect. So I'm not sure. I had this metaphor where I talked about Twitter being a new sort of signaling, but I don't know what the I guess you're helping me try to think through what are the structures that are arising that we won't have perspective now to what all it's going to turn into, but I'm I'm just suggesting that the global perspective, at least to understand that we are in the inside of some evolutionary process and that we're seeing structures appear. So we don't, I don't know what the answers are, what are the structures, but they will be parallel to what we have now for physical, emotional, intellectual, and spiritual. Does it globally? I mean, of course, in the past we've had, you know, in a way, religion, you know, was kind of a codified, controlled attempt at mass spirituality, if you like. And the scientific method is an approach to have, you know, a mass cooperative intellectual endeavor. So it's not that we are, this is the first thing that's new. When I talk about the political singularity or people talk about the technological singularity, it's not wholly new, the idea that we're coming together at higher levels. It's just that the pace is being accelerated and new things are being enabled by digital technologies. So, and like, you know, not only the computer, but the internet, so that we're all connected around the world. And there does seem to be a turning of emotion in the world. I mean, people get their guard up, and, you know, we're turning towards authoritarianism when people start acting out of fear as a whole. You know, it's the idea of emotion being contagious, but that's a subtle thing.
Well,
how that happens.
Yeah. I think it's. You know, it's reasonable that, you know, that people have a certain carrying capacity for uncertainty, and that, you know, when they start approaching their limits, or they start, you know, going over their limits, that they naturally start shedding off, you know, holding ideas or thoughts that, you know, that require a certain amount of uncertainty to hold, right? So, for example, if, you know, if you're making a decision about, you know, which college to go to, let's say you're in high school, the fact that you've got two or more that you're choosing from, well, that means you're holding uncertainty in your body because you don't know which one you're going to. So you don't know exactly how to plan for the future. Now, if you start throwing in other things in your life, you know, like, you know, if your parents are having difficulty, or if all of a sudden your grades are dropping off, or your peer group is giving you a lot of pressure, you know, it can create a situation where some things that you were thinking about to make a decision, maybe you stop thinking about them altogether. You just take them right out of your mind because you just don't have the capacity to hold them. It's sort of like, right, in physics, right, there's the uncertainty principle, sort of the idea there's always a minimum amount of uncertainty. So this is sort of like a certainty principle, and that is, you know, people have to have at least some certainty in their life. And, you know, that doesn't mean that, you know, once you've taken the uncertainty out of your mind that the rest of the world is settled. It just means that you're not including that in your consciousness. You're not including that as part of the considerations in your mind. And that, you know, in a way, you know, when society starts getting complex, you know, part of the way we deal with it is by, you know, specialization of labor. And so it shouldn't be surprising that over time we develop a certain specialization of consciousness. Sort of the idea that, you know, if you're a worker and you've got a specific job and you do it full time and you have a family and, you know, you're you know, keeping track of your friends, by the time you've got all that, there may be no time to, you know, really sit down and consider about all the implications at a political level, at a high level. And so, you know, you do what you can to reduce the uncertainty, and part of that reducing the uncertainty is just not making those decisions for yourself, not considering them, you know, just
Well, I want to juxtapose that. I think it's just another example of a putting together a model of how thinking works. And, you know, when I taught a course with James Leitner on perspective of global investing, by the way, just a footnote, there's an idea I stole from Jim Leitner earlier. I mentioned about corporations being able to buy out themselves. That was from him. But anyway, when we taught the course, we talked to students about Descartes' view versus Spinoza's view about how people process information. That in a Descartes view, people have some candidate knowledge that they're bringing in, right? That they're told some fact or they have some theory. They don't know whether or not it's true or not. So in a Descartes model, basically they hold it kind of in a provisional space in their brain and judge it as new information comes in, whether or not they should accept it or reject it. And Spinoza's point of view was more that, well, people just kind of provisionally accept things. They just it's too complex for them to hold things apart in their brain, saying, I don't know if this is true or false, I'll just hold it out here. It's much simpler to just say, okay, I'll accept it, I'll believe in God or whatever. You know, I can't entertain both the idea in a very serious way that both God, maybe God exists and maybe God doesn't exist. You kind of fall into one category or another, or else it takes a lot of effort to do otherwise. And that little bit is an example, I guess, of what you would call the certainty principle, that in a sense it takes a lot of effort to maintain competing models of reality in your mind. Right, less work to just say, okay, I'm gonna just go by the working assumption that my model of reality is this. Even if it's wrong, it's like you said, the reflex action. It's just so much more efficient to, you know, if you have here, let's be mathematical a bit about it for a second. If you have a space of possible models of reality that have a bunch of little dials on it that each can have five different positions. So if you have a model of reality with 20 dials, which each have five different positions, and, you know, you can either just say, okay, I'm just going to fix the position of all these switches, and I'm going to react to the world based on that model. And then it's really quick versus, oh, I'm going to try every position of every switch and see what all those things are and take the average. Well, that's, you know, five positions on each switch, 20 switches, that's 5 to the 20th power. It's just, you know, astronomical number. You can't proceed that way. It's a different dynamical system or something, way of putting your certainty principle. It's too complex to maintain so many possibilities in your mind. And society also. You know, so when we talk about the global intelligence, I mean, we have such a polarized society, but it seems often people pick one camp and they say, I'm going to believe my Republican, my party on everything. You know, there's 100 different things. You know, is abortion good or bad? Is our taxes good or bad? And there's so many different switches that you could make in your model of what's the right way to run a society. It's a lot easier for people to just say, no, I'm just going to pick the settings given to me, the default settings from my party versus the other party. And then you get this polarization. And so somehow the neurons in our brain work out. Sometimes we take knowledge provisionally, but then sometimes we just take things as given. And I guess sometimes it's just memory, and, you know, things get codified, and you've got your memory, and that's kind of a fixed given of the sense of what we believe we experience. That's like the first given, what you've directly experienced. But really, even that, you just have whatever you've selected from and said, I'm going to store this in memory, and that's simplified. That's my picture of the base reality of my experience is what I remember.
Yeah, and I wanted to add something that you what you said there is again, you know, this is some of the things that have motivated me to look at the connection between economics and spirit and spirituality is that sometimes we you know, accept a world view, or we accept you know, something as you know, a paradigm or a way of understanding the world, not because it's true, but because of its usefulness. And and this is certainly consistent with you know, evolutionary principles, you know, which is almost ironic, in that if you know, if believing in you know, a monotheistic world, you know, there's a single God, and if believing that, you know, the universe is 6,000 years old, and, you know, there is no evolution, if that gives you an advantage, you know, in daily life, if it gives you an advantage in procreating, you know, certainly if it ends up giving you any kind of, you know, military or political advantage, from an evolutionary standpoint, that's the one that's going to be dominant, you know, until it, you know, ceases to be useful. And you know, just kind of raised the question of, you know, science has been, you know, in its, you know, somewhat like its current form around maybe 500 years or so. And it has led to many wonderful insights, you know, deeper understanding of the world. It's certainly been a basis for huge movements forward in technology. But it does kind of raise the question of, you know, to what extent is scientific secular worldview still, you know, evolutionarily advantageous. You know, in some ways, you know, people that are not thinking too much about the future, right, may not be so, you know, as fearful of, you know, what will happen to their children. Maybe they're more likely to have children or have more of them. Whereas those that, you know, think a lot about the future, or, you know, kind of really, you know, kind of aware of all the possible things that could, you know, if they end up not having children, then from an evolutionary standpoint, that's not advantageous. You know, it's kind of ironic, right, that that, you know, belief in evolution may not be evolutionarily advantageous.
Yeah, and this is all independent of the abstract, whether you believe there is an abstract truth about evolution or not, or God or not, because we're just talking about within what we can observe of society, is it useful for the purposes of propagating itself as an idea by by its carriers, which are people's minds. So, I mean, the idea propagates itself both by people having children that they can pass on that way of thinking to, and also by influencing others who have that thinking. Nevertheless, it's hard to resist an evolutionary point of view, at least for me. I mean, even somebody who doesn't believe in Darwinian evolution by survival of the fittest to bring about life, they could say, no, it's just God made it that way. Be agnostic about that. But for the future, for the evolution of society now, it's hard to, when I'm talking to you at least, resist that, well, that's the way that kind of works. Even if, as you said, the irony is, it's hard for me to resist, maybe because I'm in my head and you're trying to think, get an overview of the whole system, but maybe people who are getting an overview of the whole system aren't the ones that can survive, just like those individual neurons, right? The brain, you know, neurons weren't evolved to be independent thinking, deep thinkers. Neurons were evolved to be really fast-reacting things that, you know, are part of a brain that they can't even imagine what that is. And that somehow, you know, just like people actually on computers and artificial neural networks find that possible to have distributed memory across many different neurons, you know, to store a pattern in the same way. And people know the brain kind of has distributed memory. It's not in an individual neuron. I think that's a fundamental struggle, and religion has a classic way of dealing with it. I mean, the struggle I'm about to say is, you know, how do you value each human life as the most precious thing, and at the same time say we're all subservient to something greater? That's a real conundrum, and a simple solution is to say, well, God loves you all, right? I mean, you're important, and
right.
God loves you, each of you individually, and you can relax and trust this and be happy about this, and you don't have to feel the highest thing is for your individual survival in an evolutionary sense or any other sense. Like, you don't have to fear death as the worst thing because, you know, there's an afterlife. Or maybe in a different spirituality, you'll say it differently, karma or whatever. These are kind of classic ways people figured out as a society to sort through and organize themselves. And, many people have, quote unquote, outgrown them, and we're at a loss spiritually because, you know, somehow we're sucked into so much of modern science, and yet we've lost some simplicity. We left the garden, right? We have the apple of knowledge. We left the garden. We don't have that simple life anymore, but yet we're compelled by metaphors like the Garden of Eden in a direct relationship with God. We long for that simplicity, which, as you can say, that simplicity ironically has an evolutionary advantage. If we're going to be like individual neurons, we just want to function by reflex, quickly and simply and happy with our role.
Yeah, or as some people might say, you really don't want to know how the sausage is made.
Yeah, right. Especially when you're part of the sausage.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Well, maybe with that, we'll call a end to the night. How does that sound to you?
So really, are we going to end this on the note of, I guess we're just part of the sausage? Let's we can end, but take us out on a higher plane spiritual metaphor. I'll hand it to you to take us out as the host.
I guess the key insight here is that, when we talk about economics and spirit, there is a feedback mechanism. The economic choices that we make show up in the material things that we have and the things that we do tangibly in the world and how it affects our relationships. And that affects, how effectively we can express our spirit. And, from the outside, people can only see what we're doing and can only infer our spirit from that. And so sometimes, because of the limitations that we have in our lives, we don't express, our highest preferred spiritual state. And then, people don't see what's inside of us in the same way, and then they change their behavior, and then we respond to that. And part of the challenge that we have is to be able to step back and realize that we're all limited by the material world that we work through, and by the social institutions that we have, and that in many ways we all of us do work from a high spiritual calling or a spiritual motivation, then, for the most part, we can see in our lives. And, maybe part of the challenge of, the next few years as the world is dealing with all the difficulties and conflicts is, to remind ourselves that, there can be, much deeper good there than we'd expect, and to kind of leave an opening that someone, including ourselves, can show up in more inspiring ways than we otherwise would think.
Well, much more inspirational note. That's a much more inspirational note to end on. Thank you, Dax. I appreciate the conversation. I hope we can do this again.
I would like to thank you, Scott, for taking such a good chunk of your time and sharing all your thoughts. Much
okay,
appreciated.
Great. And we'll listen to it on the archive, I guess. It'll be available.
It'll
Is
be
right?
available on the archive. Yep. So
okay, we've been immortalized. Thank you, Doc. Bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Well, everyone, that will be the show for tonight. I'll be on again next Wednesday, and we'll see who will co-host then. Enjoy the week, and so long.
Thanks for listening to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. Join us 7 nights a week for exciting programming covering a variety of expressions of faith. And remember, all manifestations of the divine are equally valid.